You're listening to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 AM and 930 AM. During the next hour, the Archdiocese of Chicago brings you conversation about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Welcome to Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
Good morning. I'm Michael May with the Archdiocese of Chicago's Radio TV office, and I'm happy to be with you on Relevant Radio. Every Saturday morning, we bring you highlights of our Catholic Chicago radio programs that air throughout the week. There was lots of great discussion this week, starting with Monday's Catholic Chicago program hosted by Father Greg Sakowitz. First off, in honor of the 74th anniversary of D-Day, Father Greg sat down with author Edward E. Gordon to talk about his latest book that highlights how conflicts and rivalries jeopardized the Allied victory at Normandy.
74 years ago, on Wednesday, the invasion of D-Day. Edward, that's unbelievable.
And today, on June the 4th, 74 years ago, in the morning, the commanders, Eisenhower and the others, made the decision to postpone the invasion a day because it was supposed to be on June 5th because there was a big storm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was at 4 in the morning on June the 4th, all right? They even had to
the
stop.
The invasion was to have been June 5.
5, right. Because that's when the tides would be right. So they had to postpone it because the sea was too rough. And then in the evening of that day, there was a break in the weather, and they decided they could launch it on June the 6th. And then they reconfirmed that again on the morning of June the 5th.
Now, the very fact they had to do it on June 6th and not June 5th, is it true that as these, not ships, but these, what do you call these little boats that were coming in?
Landing craft
were coming in, that in many cases, some of the men drown getting off the landing craft because the water was too deep and the gear just brought them down.
Well, they were carrying. A lot of them were launched too far out by mistake, all right?
Say more about that.
Well, the admiral, there was an American admiral in charge of the American landing beaches and a British admiral in charge of the British, with Admiral Ramsay, British, who planned Neptune, which was the whole plan. And Admiral Kirk, the American admiral.
Would this be David's father?
No.
This is somebody else.
David's father was Admiral Ramsay.
Okay, got it.
Kirk was the American.
Got it.
So Kirk launched a lot of the amphibious tanks way too far away, and almost all of them sank with the men inside.
Wow.
And they were important because they were going to take out the bunkers with their guns close up. So only a few of them. This is Omaha Beach I'm talking about now. And then when the men got closer, because of the fact that the water was rough and the fire was very heavy in Omaha Beach, the Coast Guard actually did. They were in charge of the landing craft. Most people don't realize that, the U.S. Wow. Coast Guard, all right? They launched many of the men too far out, and they had like 60 pounds of supplies on their back. They stepped off into water that was maybe chest deep, and they sank and drowned.
Wow.
All right? So there were mistakes made, and there were also correct things. For Utah Beach, they landed a mile away from where they were supposed to land, and there was a gap in the defenses. It was by accident. If they had landed where they had intended, there were all these guns. They would have had a repeat of Omaha Beach. So Roosevelt—
At Utah Beach.
At Utah Beach. And Roosevelt, who was the grandson of Teddy, he was the general that landed with the troops, and they said, oh, this is the wrong place. He said, well, the war starts here, and they went inland, and that was the one beach that achieved its goals on D-Day of the five beaches. Omaha, Utah Beach was the most successful of all the landing.
And yet it was almost an accident because they were a mile from their target.
They had drifted.
And otherwise Utah would have been a repeat of Omaha.
Could have been.
Now, what were the five landings that was you had?
Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Gold was a British beach, Juneau was a Canadian beach, and Sword was the British beach.
And all this happened on June 6th.
That all happened on June 6th. And because it was delayed, the Germans did not have the weather stations in the Atlantic like we did in Greenland and elsewhere. So they were fooled. And as a result, many of the German generals were at field exercises, war games. On June 6th was Rommel's wife's 50th birthday, he had gone for that and to see Hitler to get more panzer divisions brought to Normandy. So he wasn't there. But the Germans were fooled because Ramsay, Admiral Ramsay, when he wrote the plan to put these 7,000 ships across, he figured halfway across, the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, and the Navy would see them coming. And so halfway across, they'd start attacking. Because of the storm, and it was still rough, but it was not as rough, they only lost one ship of the 7,000 ships, and that was to a mine off the beaches. When they got there, they hit a German mine. A few turned back because of mechanical problems. In fact, most of the ships during the amphibious assault phase for the first few weeks that were sunk mainly by mines,
not
by naval or air
power. Let's just flip gears a little bit to Edward Manners. Talk about the faith dimension. Connect the whole thing with the faith dimension. How does that tie in?
Well, when you go to Normandy to visit, you should start your trip at the little village of Saint-Mère-Église, because that's where the first U.S. paratroopers landed. The paratroopers came in to prevent the Germans from reinforcing the beaches. All right? One of them, of course, is a very famous paratrooper. He landed on the church steeple. Wow. And in the movie The Longest Day, Red Buttons portrays him, Private Steele, and he is suspended over the town, and some of the other guys landed in the town. The Germans shot him. But when you go to Saint-Mère-Église, go inside that chapel, because in the chapel, in the stained glass windows, are beautiful memorials to the American paratroopers landing in that church, in that area.
Wow. One landed on the steeple.
Yes, and was suspended. They finally cut him down. He lived. He did not die. And across from that is a museum for the 82nd Airborne. Now, of course, when you leave there, right nearby, behind Utah Beach, because that's not too far, is a huge cemetery. But this is filled with Germans. And there's a big iron cross in the middle, and then all these little iron crosses. The men are buried six men deep to each grave. Mm. And nearby is the town of Bayer, and there is a huge Commonwealth cemetery where the British and Canadians and others are buried. And then behind Omaha Beach is the American Cemetery, which is very heart-rending when you go in there and you see all of these crosses of all these men that died in the campaign itself, thousands and thousands of men. And Eisenhower returned to that beach in 1964, and this is what he said. These men came here, British and our allies and Americans, to storm these beaches for one purpose only, not to gain anything for themselves, not to fulfill ambition for America for conquest, but just to preserve freedom. Thousands of men died for such ideals as these, but these young boys were cut off in their prime. I devoutly hope that we never again will see such a scene as these. I think and hope and pray that humanity will have learned that we must find some way to gain eternal peace for the world.
Amen. What a quote. So it was 20 years after the invasion.
Yes.
In 1964. Edward, how can someone purchase this brand new, marvelous book?
Well, I'm happy to tell you it's available all over America in bookstores, Barnes & Noble, private bookstores, online through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can easily get it as a hardcover book, has 32 maps, 36 photos, or an ebook as well.
And who produced it, or who is the publisher?
Prometheus, but it's distributed through Doubleday and Penguin.
And so it's called Divided on D-Day, How Conflicts and Rivalries Jeopardized the Allied Victory at Normandy, Dr. Edward Gordon and David Ramsey.
Now remember, my name is Ed. I don't make house calls. I don't write prescriptions. I do have a doctorate in history. That's true.
So we'll call you the doctor. So Edward and it. But now, in your book, is there any humor in the book?
Oh, absolutely. So when they initially wrote the plan for the invasion, it was written by a General Morgan, who was British, and then they worked on it and refined it. But he sent his aide to, when they had written the plan, they sent an aide to get a code name for the operation, because they separated operations by different code names. And the only code name that was available at that time was Mothball.
Mothball?
Mothball. And he said, when I bring this plan, because Churchill wanted to see the plan before anybody else, he said, Churchill's never going to go along with this. So he Morgan took it, and he presented it, and Churchill said, mothball, you mean to tell me that I must tell my grandchildren that the great invasion to free Western Europe was called mothball? This is ridiculous. I will come up with a better name. So he had his cigar in his mouth. He sat for a few seconds. He came and he took it out and he said, Overlord, we will call this Overlord. And that was his biggest contribution, believe me, to the invasion, was naming it Operation Overlord.
Isn't that something? So he refused to go with mothball.
Yeah, I don't think mothball would have made it. I don't think you'd have had me on tonight, today, if we were going to talk about mothballs.
Mothballs. And that's a true story.
True story.
What's the second funny story?
The second story is about a...
That's a good one. I like that.
The second story is about a veteran who was celebrating his 100th birthday. And I went to his birthday party, and I found out at the party that he had been in Patton's Third Army. And Patton's part of his, the division he was in, the 28th Division, was helped to liberate Paris. And there are several iconic pictures of World War II. One of them is raising the flag on Iwo Jima. You remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
And then there's another one of all these men marching down the Champs-Élysées in Paris, and the Arch of Triumph is right behind them. You probably have seen that.
Yes,
picture.
I have.
All right. Well, that's the 28th Infantry Division. So he was in that march. I was shocked as I was writing about it at the time. So I said, well, can you tell me how you felt and what the people were like? He said, oh, the people were so overjoyed because we were marching to give them freedom. They had been under the German boot for 4.5 years of occupation. And then he said, well, of course, there was another problem. He said, the guys on either end of the line, because it was a broad boulevard like Michigan Avenue, the women on both sides were giving them hugs and kisses and food and wine. I was stuck in the middle.
Of the march.
I didn't get anything. I was really ticked off the whole day.
Now, that's a great story. So you were talking to a veteran of World War II, his 100th birthday, who was part of the march into France for freedom, and he wasn't getting any hugs or kisses or food. He was in the middle of the parade or in the middle of the group, and the end guys were getting all the affirmation and the hugs.
That's right.
And that's a great, great, great story. And you were actually talking to him at his celebration, and he's going back all these years.
On his 100th birthday.
Sure, and then he would have been in his 20s and the invasion of D-Day and the liberation. So it always impresses me is that...
And that veteran's name, by the way, is Raymond Sola. And
this was, what, about a year or two ago?
This is about a year and a half ago.
Is he still living?
He is. I don't think he's very well at the moment.
But so
he was driving his own car at the time. He had just passed his driver's test, and he was living alone at this time.
Amazing.
On his 100th birthday.
How many, I know this is an impossible question to answer, regarding the invasion of Normandy, how many are still living?
Very few, because now most of them are in their 90s. They're dying at a very rapid rate now.
In their 90s.
In their 90s. And he was 25 at the time, which was very old for most of those men were 18, 19, 20 years old.
Have you had a chance to talk to many veterans of World War II?
Yes.
At Normandy?
I have talked to many veterans. We had a wonderful lunch at Kiki's Bistro a few years ago. I think it was for the 65th anniversary, and he invited all the D-Day veterans, wow, and I gave a little speech to all these veterans. He gave them a free lunch, and there was a lot of news coverage of that particular event.
We need to bring the program to this half to a close. Divided on D-Day, how conflicts and rivalries jeopardize the Allied victory at Normandy. Edward, one more time, how someone can purchase the book.
At Barnes & Noble, or most local bookstores will have it. You can order it, or you can get it online in many, many outlets.
And Edward Gordon, along with David Ramsey. Edward, I want to say thank you very much. It was an incredibly fast half hour. And you just scratch the surface, and I'm holding the book right here.
And for more information, look at our website, historypresentations.com.
One more time.
Historypresentations.com.
Thanks to Father Greg and Edward for that fascinating conversation. Next, Father Greg talked to a couple of his brother priests, Father Brad Zamora and Father Carl Morello, about the upcoming priest convocation.
An important part of our work is the pastoral ministry. So you phrase it, compassion without surrender, and speak
Correct.
More about the whole sense of pastoral ministry as we serve the people of God.
So one of the issues sometimes that we're looking at today are just young people getting married in church or not. A lot of people are doing destination weddings. And so what we find is that many young people will come, and they may not be part of the community, but they like the church, or maybe their parents were married here, or they went to school. Some pastors are very strict. If you're not a parishioner, no marriage. Others are more welcoming. So it's those kinds of issues, not surrendering our values, but also treating people with respect and compassion. And that's something that's been a great thing by Pope Francis.
He talked to us about being a field hospital, and he uses the image that, you know, medics in the war zone are not serving by staying in the tent, but they go out to their people. And also he
Correct.
Talks about smell like your sheep. Which I
yeah.
think you have to be,
yeah.
you know, smell like your
so
sheep.
So I'm looking forward to his comments on this whole idea of compassion without surrender.
Yeah, and I think
what
that,
does that look like?
You know, I mean, with three of us as priests, and of course, with Brad being the youngest, how do you serve the people of God but uphold the values, the integrity of the church, but somehow serve the people of God and ask, what do you want to have happen?
Correct.
And being there for people. And now, along those lines, Brad, talk to us about the witness talks by our brother priests.
Yeah, so often I think when any type of group gather, you're often talked at, meaning you're learning something, you're kind of held captive there. One of the things that we really discerned as a committee was actually bringing what Bishop McElroy is going to be speaking about to us into the lived experience of the priests of our archdiocese. And so we've been blessed that two of our brothers have kind of responded to our invitation as a committee to get up following both of Bishop McElroy's talks and kind of witness to the realities that he's speaking to us about. So again, he's talking about being in the person of Christ today. So how do you live that out within the context of the ministry that you're called to serve in? And so Father Mark Bartosik, who's the pastor at Assumption down on 26th in California, and also the director of Colby House, which is the prison ministry, is going to witness to what it means to be in persona Christi within the context of his ministry in that very diverse neighborhood, number one, serving at Assumption, but also what does it mean to be Christ in a prison setting and running that ministry and journeying with people who are incarcerated. Certainly one of the corporal works of mercy being, of course, visiting the imprisoned. So how does that relate to his priestly ministry? And then we've asked maybe one of our eldest clerics in the diocese, Bishop Jack Gorman, to witness to that reality and how it's been lived out, not only in his priesthood with the varied experiences that he's had, but also as a bishop, being in many different roles in the diocese, ultimately now, you know, residing out in Orland Park at Our Lady of the Woods out there. How does he see that in persona Christi being lived out today as well? And so that witness from the brothers to the brothers is hopefully going to lead us into just some conversations around tables, kind of breaking down maybe whatever walls we might see generationally or ethnically in the presbyterate, and just getting back to that common denominator that all of us are priests, all of us are called to be Christ to our people. Here are two of our brothers witnessing to that. How can we continue that conversation now individually?
And here you have Bishop Gorman, who's about 92 years old, once the rector of Mundelein Seminary back in the 60s.
Right.
In that time of transition. That was even before our time, Carl, because we both were there in the, well, for me, 75, 79, you were 79, 83. And so it was a different presbyterate in those days. And maybe just a question for both of you before we go into the break. You know, Carl, as pastor at St. Giles in Oak Park, and Brad, you are on the faculty at Mundelein Seminary. So two wonderful brother priests doing completely, in some ways, different ministry. Carl, I have to ask you this question. From the day you were ordained until now, how has your ministry changed in terms of how you serve the people? It's a tough question.
Well, it's a good question, and I will say this, that the needs of the people and how we minister is constantly being challenged, which mm-hmm. is one of the things we'll look at the convocation. But I'll remember this. My very first pastor, Don Ahern, when
oh,
I was
gosh.
At St. Juliana's.
Class of 51.
Don,
tremendous
at St.
priest.
Juliana's. When I was ordained a priest, he told me this. He said, say yes whenever you can and love your people, and they will always love you back. And those words have proven to be true for me throughout my ministry, no matter what the challenges are. I think you say yes when you can, and you do it with compassion and love, and you can't help but to find, to follow Christ and to be successful.
Now, it's interesting you say that, Carl, because my first pastor, Father George Kane, is also a classmate of Father Don Ahern, both ordained in 1951, the year before yep. Bishop Gorman. And George used to say the very same thing to me, say yes when you can. Isn't it funny? Mm-hmm. They were classmates. They were also good friends, along with Father Leo Mann and others. And
yep.
that's exactly as when I'm a baby priest, and George is always saying to me, say yes when you can, assume the goodness of people, and see where it goes. And he knew, and yes. he knew that. And both Don Ahern and George Kane, of course, Don is with the Lord, and George is now 92, retired in Schaumburg. And so, but saying the same thing, and here, look, and they were ordained 66 years ago.
It's always great to hear priests be enthusiastic about their work. Next up, we will hear from a former official with the NAACP. We'll be back in a moment.
Do you have questions about the meaning of life, love, and sexuality? And how about inner peace, true happiness, and romantic relationships? What is the role of the church in all of this? And how does one come to an understanding of the deepest mysteries of the human heart? Come join us in the retreat called Echo Chicago this June, where we will address all of these great things and more. Hey everyone, my name is Ray Pingoy from the Respect Life Ministries of the Archdiocese of Chicago, and I want to invite you to Echo Chicago. This June, the Archdiocese of Chicago will host a Theology of the Body summer camp for teens and young adults. We have partnered with Dumb Ox Ministries to present a week of prayer, fun, and immersion in the teachings of St. Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body. This exciting camp will take place at St. Xavier University in Chicago, June 22nd to the 28th. Registration is still open. For more information, go to respectlifechicago.org or call 312-534-5355.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review, where we bring you highlights from the Archdiocese of Chicago radio programs that air Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning on WNDZ 750 AM. David E. Lowry, former NAACP president of the South Suburban Branch, visited with Deacon John Cook on Tuesday's Black Catholic Initiative program. Let's listen in.
I'm sure you realize that, you know, God is the heart. He's at the heart of everything. And it is He who makes us breathe and live the kind of life that we live. In this new calling that you have and in this life that you live, what do you find that you enjoy most in what you're doing? And what are some of your greatest challenges?
Well, first, I enjoy life each and every day. And I thank God every second that I'm still here.
Yes.
To be able to do it. My mission is to get people to understand that we are Americans. You know, this country was built on the fact of there's really no person that can lay claim to America but the American Indians. So basically, we're all minorities to this country. It's about time that we start acting like Americans. It should not matter what color we are. We're all children of God. And so we need to start looking at it from that perspective, because we basically right now are destroying this planet with the envy, the hatred, all the racism that's going on. And God is not pleased with us. You know, the Bible talks about in the last days and times, the famine, the earthquakes, the fires. All these things have come to fruition. And those who believe in the Lord should be looking at that and thinking about ways how we can start to turn back the hands of time and get to a place where we can live in this country together as one people, besides being different. And that's been my biggest challenge, is to get folks to see that. Because tomorrow is not promised to anybody, you know?
You know, I agree with you, David. And I guess the only thing that I'm sort of indifferent about is when you say, we can turn back the hands of time. I wish that we could turn back the hands of time. But the fact of the matter is we cannot turn back the hands of time because we are in this time. And you just explained it wonderfully. We are in perilous times. And so when you have youth and you have parents that have raised these youth where there is no presence of God, how do you turn back the hands of time? I'm just going to complete that thought and say, I think we have to just deal with people to where they are, because where they are is not where we were some 10, 20 years ago.
Well, a lot of times when I walk out I go out and spend a lot of times in the different communities, I talk to a lot of the troubled youth who might be involved with drugs. They living on the streets. You know, I try to let them know that there is a different way in life. And with this foundation, we've been able to save a lot of our young people to get them back at school. A lot of them are totally uneducated. A lot of them have psychological problems that needs to be addressed. And it's really sad that, you know, we took discipline out of the home.
Yes.
And once we did that, we did not allow our children to get or build a relationship with God. You know, and that's the biggest problem that we have today, is that these children are spiritually dead.
Yes.
When we came along, you know, whether I wanted to go to church on Sundays or not, I had to, or I was going to suffer the consequences of a whooping.
Exactly.
So even though I went to church, even though sometimes I fell asleep, the word would enter my ears and in my heart, and then at some point in my life, it would manifest itself, which it did. And so I think that the spirituality of people have disintegrated, and that's the problem that we have when you have a person that doesn't have a good spirit, a godly spirit, then you see what we see now. You have kids killing kids. You have police officers killing unarmed men and women. This fact that we've turned our face away from God and is trying to live and be gods ourselves is going to cost us this earth and a loss of a lot of lives.
And you're absolutely right on that. And yet we know too, though, you and I, because we're believers, that it's still in God's hands, and God still has a master plan. Even the Bible says that man makes plans, but God orders his steps. So, you know, we might not be able to see it in this lifetime, and we may not be able to see it, all of us, as God is creating this new earth and new life for us. But we can trust in him and know that it's going to be okay.
Well, you know, Brother Cook, it's that simple. When you find the Lord, really, it changes your life. You're talking about a sinner myself who was into drugs and drinking, womanizing, always been a good father. I took care of my kids. But there was other things that God had planned for me. And when I died and came back, I quit drinking. I don't do nothing now. I did whatever he told me to do, and I'm truly being blessed. But we have to really understand this. It is time for us to put down religion. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Religion has separated God's people. You know, you have the apostolics, the Catholics, you have the Christians. All of these people, there's one God, but they serve God differently, and that should be fine. But at this point and at this juncture, all of believers should be getting together and change the direction that mankind is going in right now. And so once we realize that we're all the same, we serve the same God, everybody believes in Jesus, then we should be in one room deciding the faith, because it's going to take us. We can't no longer wait for these people who are not believers to change the dynamics here, because they're going to make it worse if they don't serve the same God we serve. But God's people need to stand up right now and reclaim this world, because that's what he put us here as leaders to be able to do that.
And I'm in agreement with that. I mean, this is a spiritual warfare. And the only way that we're going to be able to combat it is through the Spirit and through our belief and faith in God. And I agree with you, David, that our leaders, our church leaders, our believers, we need to step forward and we need to, I believe we can change the tide. In fact, I know we can make a difference.
Our thanks to Deacon John and David E. Lowry for sharing their thoughts with our listeners. Stay with us. We'll hear from Monsignor Michael Boland when we return from these short messages.
The cemetery ministry is a core ministry of our Catholic faith tied to the corporal works of mercy. It's comforting to know that our Catholic cemeteries are caring for the remains of our loved ones awaiting the resurrection. There are 44 Archdiocese of Chicago Catholic cemeteries willing to help you in your time of loss. Call 708-449-6100 or visit CatholicCemeteriesChicago.org. Catholic Cemeteries, serving the Catholic community since 1837.
You're listening to Catholic Chicago Week in Review on Relevant Radio 950 AM and 930 AM. Every Saturday from 9 to 10 AM, the Archdiocese of Chicago presents programming about the people, events, and issues that touch our lives. Thanks for letting us be part of your morning. Now again, Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review. I'm Michael May of the Archdiocese of Chicago's radio TV office. This past Tuesday, Monsignor Michael Boland, CEO of Catholic Charities of Chicago, had a conversation with Frederica Malone about how violence affects children.
We're having a conversation this morning about our Inspiring Hope program that is out at our Father Augustus Tolton Center, and we're talking this morning with Frederica Malone, who is our clinical supervisor there, about this Inspiring Hope program, and maybe we talk a little bit about the successes that you've seen so far,
sure.
Even though it's a short period of time.
Yes.
So we've been there.
It has been a short period of time, but I do believe that, you know, we are having an impact. We've had quite a few people who have come in, and because of what they're benefiting from, have gone back into the community, spoken with family members and others about our services, and have said that they've benefited, and why not come and seek help for themselves as well. We've had one gentleman we've been working with fairly from the beginning, who is a veteran, but who is also homeless and has a long history of child abuse. And he's already working on getting into the job circuit, and we're helping him with housing. And so he's been able to provide us with feedback on how he feels about our services that we've been able to give back to ICJA to let them know how he feels about our services, our workers, and the organization as well.
Mm-hmm. That's really great, because I think it's a tremendous compliment to what you're doing and what we're doing there, is when people are able to say, that's a good place.
Yes.
You know, the people there are good. They want to help you. There's no agenda other than trying to help you. And I think, unfortunately, especially for many of our homeless population and just people who are struggling, they have really no one to talk to. You know, there is no human interaction oftentimes for days or weeks, and I think that's what just becomes so difficult or challenging, or to see the world in such a cold and dark light. Mm-hmm. And when you start to realize these places that are there, like the Peace Center, the Peace Corner, just in Austin alone, are really places of welcome and beacon of hope, and and inspiring people to hope again, you know, and that's really a challenge because you're really taking somebody who's really learned not to trust people, learned not to hope. Why would you hope if you have no trust? And once you can develop the trust, you can then hope again. You can begin to once again see the future and or that you're a part of it or you're part of society. And, you know, and so I think that sometimes those are, you know, the very sometimes baby steps in one sense, but in reality they are life-giving events because they can put the person back on their right path. And then society is the one that benefits because you have this person who's gifted and talented mm-hmm. is now sharing those gifts and talents. They aren't just being wasted or being lost because of the challenges that they face. And, you know, and I hope that as we talk about the Tolton Center and the Inspiring Hope Program that we can, you know, have a better conversation about Austin and help people understand its goodness and long history. You know, up until like last year was the largest populated zip code in the city of Chicago mm-hmm. for 40-something years. And so, and with the, you know, the L right there and the transportation, it is a great location. And it's just trying to help people be able to, because I think once, you know, we can begin, again, this is incrementally, but trying to help people in these in a community like Austin to recapture their strength and their glory of goodness. When we always start first, I think, with that, then you realize that in any community, I don't care where it is, there is always a sense of brokenness or a sense of struggle or a sense of victims mm-hmm. of violence. But in some places they have resources or individuals, they have families to help them. We have to be that for that community there, you know, for a while to strengthen them and to help them and so that they'll see that long-term impact, you know.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, that's what's just really so important. And people need, I think, a sense of professionalized services like that you're offering. You know, they need somebody who understands them and understands their situation. And, I mean, I'm just not surprised that there's not more people with, when they talk about PTSD from our military officials, you know, they come back after seeing violence, and yet there's people in these communities that are suffering in the same way, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that are there day in and day out. They're not going to be there for a short time. It's their life and their home and their families. So I hope that we can really begin to help and recognize that people might be having different kind of challenges, but the fact is we are there to help them, you know.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's really important. What would you see some of the specific challenges that the clients there in Austin are experiencing?
You know, overwhelmingly, we've been encountering quite a few who are experiencing difficulty with stability in housing. Many people facing eviction, or they may already be homeless. Financial instabilities, difficulties with maintaining jobs, drug addiction, and there's this intergenerational cycle of abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has probably been the most deeply impactful when we uncover people's histories, as mm-hmm. we get to know them. Everyone that has come in for something else has a history of some form of violence that's been perpetrated against them.
Mm-hmm.
And multi-generationally, we will work with grandparents, aunts, and uncles to help them better understand how that has impacted them, as not just only within the family individually, but how that translates to their functioning within the greater community.
Mm-hmm.
So the cycle of violence is something that we look to try to stop.
Yeah.
And provide families with skills to create a safe space, not only just at home, but as well as in the community.
Mm-hmm. Because it is, I mean, all these kind of issues what you were talking about are all cyclical in the sense in a family if they're not being addressed and or being dealt with in a positive way. And
right.
Most people don't have the strength to do that. I mean, they don't have the mm-hmm. skill set to do that, and they need someone to help them, you know.
It's always great to hear about the many ways Catholic Charities provides care and services to our community's most vulnerable citizens and those in need, regardless of their religious beliefs. After this break, we will hear from an outstanding young priest, Father Matt O'Donnell. We'll be right back.
Have you checked out Chicago Catholic lately? Either in print or online, Chicago Catholic has informative and stimulating content, including news from the Archdiocese, beautiful photographs, and a thoughtful column by our publisher, Cardinal Blaise Supich. Editor Joyce DeRiga tells us about our current edition of Chicago Catholic.
Catholic Charities dedicates the Father Augustus Tolton Peace Center in the Austin neighborhood. We introduce you to the 19 permanent deacons recently ordained by Cardinal Supich. Muslims and Catholics break bread for the annual iftar dinner during Ramadan, and Resurrection Parish holds a Corpus Christi procession to pray for peace after recent violence in their neighborhood.
Subscribe now. Go to ChicagoCatholic.com or call 312-534-7777. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Chicago Catholic, a fresh approach to Catholic news.
Imagine spending a week in a beautiful lakeside setting where you can pray, reflect, and learn more about the treasures of the Bible. This wonderful opportunity can be yours at the annual Summer Scripture Conference at the University of St. Mary of the Lake Mundelein Seminary. Notable Christian scholars from across the United States will present this year's program, Making All Things New, the Holy Spirit in the Bible. The four major speakers will discuss how the Holy Spirit was portrayed and understood in different biblical times and communities. The Summer Scripture Seminar will be held Sunday through Friday, June 24th through the 29th. Stay for the week or sign up for sets of three lectures. For details, call 847-837-4558 or go to summerscripture.org. The Summer Scripture Seminar offers you spiritual renewal and inspiration with people who share your passion for the Word of the Lord.
Welcome back to Catholic Chicago Week in Review, where we bring you highlights from Archdiocese of Chicago radio programs that air Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning on WNDZ 750 AM. On Wednesday's Fully Alive program, Ryan Lentz and Liz Young from the Office of Human Dignity and Solidarity had a chance to speak with Father Matt O'Donnell, pastor of St. Columbanus Church in the Park Manor neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, a neighborhood that is all too familiar with the violence that plagues certain areas of the city.
So you want to talk a little bit about, I guess, you know, from your perspective, I know you've talked a lot about, and that tends to be kind of the main story that we hear about, you know, in communities of the South Side is just the issues of violence. But I'm sure from your perspective as someone who lives in that community, who loves that community and who has built a lot of relationships, you have an interesting perspective, I'm sure, about, you know, what are the root causes of violence in the community?
Yeah, I think that there's a number of causes for the violence in Chicago. I think here, you know, we see the effects of gang violence and gun violence that's connected with, you know, drugs that are in our community and in certain places, the rising availability of drugs. But I think that there's something much deeper than that that happens in communities, not just in Chicago, but across our country, is that there's really a lack of investment. On 71st Street, where our parish is, there isn't like a line of people wanting to open up new businesses in the community. And when there are new businesses that do want to come in, oftentimes they're somehow connected with the sale of alcohol, whether it's a lounge, a bar, or a liquor store. And a lot of residents in the community don't want to see that type of business continuing to come into the community when there's no other opportunities. And I think about a lot of the young people that we serve through our parish in a variety of different ways. And oftentimes they tell me that part of why they're out there selling drugs or standing on the corner or not being in school is they just feel that they don't know what direction to take, and they don't really know where to turn. There isn't places that they can go right there in the neighborhood to apply for a job as easily as some people might think it is. And I think that by creating opportunities for growth for people, for economic growth for people, that would have a huge impact on the amount of violence that we see in the city today.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, we've featured on this program a couple different times, you know, some of the work of this emerging, you know, violence prevention initiative that Phil Andrew is leading. Just last week, the, you know, Catholic Charities opened the Peace Center in the Austin neighborhood, and Cardinal Supich came and spoke. Monsignor Boland was there, you know, really meant to be a resource center, you know, to provide a variety of different resources. I think 30,000 people in Austin are served by Catholic Charities each year. So it's, you know, that's certainly one response. But I know that, you know, advocacy is certainly a very important part of this as well. Liz, do you want to talk a little bit about the event that is happening at St. Sabina next Friday?
Sure. So for the last several years, St. Sabina has had an end of school year peace march and rally. And I was able to go last year, and it was a really powerful experience. This is something that the community does every Friday during the summer. So parishioners and community members get together and meet at St. Sabina and then march through the neighborhood on Friday nights, really to be kind of a public presence of peace and to discourage any sort of violence or criminal activity in the neighborhood during the summer, because we know that that violence tends to rise in the summer when kids are out of school and when there's kind of less structure to their lives. And so this is kind of a kickoff for that. And this year there are some special guests on the docket, it seems, appearances from Chance the Rapper and Jennifer Hudson, as well as some students from the school where the shooting happened in Florida that are kind of have been in conversation with lots of young people in the city of Chicago over the last several months and will be joining for the march. So that march is open to the surrounding community, as well as any other Catholics or people who are just interested in being part of a concrete action and witness to peace. So that happens at 78th Place and Troop down on the south side, and that'll be from 7 to 9 p.m. on Friday, June 15th. So I know some of us will be there, and it would be great to see a large source of support for that event.
Yeah. So I saw over the weekend the students, the graduating class from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School down in Parkland had their graduation. And I believe it was Monday they announced this like summer tour, essentially, that a number of the students that have really taken on an activist role are embarking on. And I believe that the St. Sabina Peace Walk is their kind of first event. So it's really exciting that they've really identified Chicago as a location where, obviously this is an issue that matters very much to our community and, as hopefully will really bring some additional attention to it. I think, with all these different initiatives that we're trying to highlight through the Violence Prevention Initiative, it's a great opportunity, if you're listening and, you're in a community where maybe you don't see the impact of these issues on a daily basis, to show up and to make your presence known and to let folks know that, that as a Catholic, these are issues that matter deeply to you, that connect to, issues of human dignity and solidarity, and oftentimes can be a first step towards greater engagement, where we can learn more about, folks who are closest to the issue, who have great ideas about how we can address issues of violence and lack of resources in the community. During the break, Father Matt, you were talking about some of the work that you do at your parish in terms of building relationships and really trying to kind of strengthen the fabric of the community. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think our Catholic parishes all throughout the Archdiocese have this great opportunity to sort of stand at the intersection of what happens in the parish and then what's happening in the surrounding community. And for us at St. Columbanus, much like Father Flager and St. Sabina, we really do have this strong desire to be building community, to strengthening community, and providing opportunities for neighbors just to get to know one another. Because I think that's so often our story, is that we see people, but we never get to know them. We never get to interact with them. And so what we do is on every couple weeks, we host what we call pop-up clergy events. And so it's through the CAPS office of Chicago Police in the 3rd District. But it's really an opportunity for different churches and congregations and pastors and people to find something creative to do in the community to build community. And so for us, we put a huge grill. We have this big smoker grill that we put right outside the front steps of the church on 71st Street. And we don't advertise. We don't post it on Facebook. We don't do any of that type of stuff. I announce it in church asking for volunteers. And then just the fact that we're out there cooking, word spreads through the community. Mm-hmm. And so we're out there for a couple hours. And the last several times we've done this, we've served over 300 of our neighbors within the matter of an hour and a half sometimes. And so we have music out there, and it's just really a good way for the community to gather together, for the church to be doing something where we build a sense of community without making people feel like they have to be coming to church on Sunday, that we still have this commitment to the life in the neighborhood, and that the people in the community have the opportunity to interact with the police. And so all of that takes place on our front steps. And I think that's really the unique place that the church has in many issues that are going on in Chicago right now, is that we can really be a place where dialogue happens, where encounter takes place, where folks just have an opportunity to just be with one another in an environment that's safe. And hopefully from all of that, there's some type of healing and reconciliation and new life that we can bring into the community.
Yeah. I would imagine by kind of having such a space like that where people just kind of, you know, they smell the food cooking or word gets around and they just show up, and that you have folks show up who aren't necessarily showing up at Mass on Sunday necessarily. And I would imagine that that creates a really creative space where unexpected, yeah, conversations and encounters do happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Is there like an example or a story that you can think of that has kind of stood out to you in doing these pop-up clergy events?
Yeah, I think every time that we do a pop-up clergy event or at our food pantry and I'm present there and some of our other pastoral leaders are present, there's always people who come up to us asking for prayer. So even if they know that I'm a Catholic priest and they might not be Catholic or they haven't been to church in a while, they realize that there's something powerful about this opportunity to just ask for a prayer. And for me, it's very humbling because it also reminds me of what's actually going on in the lives of people in the community. And so often it's, you know, people are just asking for the strength or the perseverance, sort of the clarity that they need to get through whatever situation it is that they're facing. But that's a really great part of it, is that people know that they can ask for that, and they can come to us as leaders in the parish to just receive that type of prayer and encouragement that they need.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful that you are in our community and that we had this opportunity to get to know you a little bit and hear about the wonderful ministry that you do in Park Manor. Congratulations again for receiving this honor from the USCCB and CCHD this year.
Thank you.
Hope that it's another great opportunity to just spread the work and the ministry that you do. So,
our thanks to Father Matt and the folks from the Office of Human Dignity and Solidarity for that insight. For our final highlight this week, we turn to two Catholic nuns, Sister Lovina Pamet and Sister Mary Kay Brooks, who addressed some frequently asked questions about vocation to religious life.
So Mary Kay, we were talking about, are young people still entering religious life today? And yes, definitely, we said yes.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm.
So then, okay, if people, young people especially, are, and it doesn't have to be young people, there are some who are, we usually say between 18 to 40. And what if, you know, you're in your 30s or 40s, some might still be interested, so of course. Well, how does one join?
Well, there's every community is going to have a little difference, but there's some basics that are the same across communities. And so the first step is really to spend time in prayer and hopefully maybe even have a spiritual director to help guide you to say, is religious life really what God's calling me to? Is it just, maybe I just have a curiosity and I want to learn more, or is it really a call from God to say, you need to look at this? And so that's kind of the first piece, to become a discerner, to become an inquirer, to really spend some time and say, how serious is this from my perspective? And in that process, you might want to take time to go to what we call a come and see weekend. Especially women religious communities will have time set aside where they want women to come in and look at their life and spend time with them in prayer, ask questions, find out what's their ministry, what do they do all day long, how do they interact with each other. Get some basic answers to some of those interesting questions that you have, so that you can put that information into your bucket of things to pray about and
okay,
work with.
So you don't just get this interest then, because I think some people start getting interested by either seeing mm-hmm. a sister or a religious priest, you know, usually a missionary mm-hmm. preaching perhaps. It's very rare that you might see a brother, because usually our brothers, like Brother Jim that we talked about last month from our last show, we don't usually know where they are, even though usually they're teachers. But at the same time, some people would realize, you know, this might be something for me. Can't I just knock on the door and say, I'm here, can I just join? Or are there a lot? I mean, sometimes I feel like, okay, is it too much of a challenge to join? What are the basic stuff that is necessary? Of course, beyond, you need to be Catholic, right?
You need to be a practicing Catholic and have received the sacraments to be in good standing in the Catholic Church. You need to, you can knock on the door and say, I'm here, but they're going to have you go to a vocation director and start a conversation about what is it that draws you to this particular group? What are you looking for? How do you want to serve? How do you see yourself participating in this particular group? So there's a lot of questions that where the community needs to learn about and get to know the young person. The young person needs to learn about the community. It's a mutual relationship, and that takes time.
Yeah, Sister Mary Kay, this sounds like dating. So you know how for people, sometimes with the chemistry, they see each other, they fall in love, and then maybe next week they decide to get married. Would that ever work for religious life?
Well, no, it won't work. And I did have an experience of working with a young woman who entered. She basically met some sisters on a weekend, fell in love with their lifestyle from the outside, and joined them within a short amount of time, and then left that community because it wasn't the right fit.
Right.
And so she and I had a great conversation about taking enough time, asking enough questions to learn about the community and for the community to learn about her. So that whole getting to know each other time can take anywhere from 6 to 18 months. So you really have a good idea. And if you don't feel like this place, these women, this community is a home, then probably not the right place.
So where would I find these communities to check out?
There's great resources online. CAVA, which we will often refer to, which is the Chicago
Archdiocesan Vocation Association.
Yes, which we're both.
I should know that.
We're both members of that. CAVA has some great resources. So does NRVC, which is the National Religious
Vocation
Conference. They have some great resources as well to start to narrow down which communities are you most likely attracted to.
Mm-hmm. So what about maybe some of those who are at that stage where they are looking and searching? Let's talk a little bit more about maybe the different stages, because it doesn't happen overnight, obviously.
Oh, no.
And then I still like to make the comparison between, you know, getting married or, you know, getting into something that you want to decide for your life. So can you equate a little bit more of the dating, you know, getting to know each other in terms of the initial stage for those who are discerning?
So the first is what we talked about, the inquirer or the discerner, where it could be 6 to 18 months, where you're just spending time with the sisters, coming for meals, having prayer, maybe doing a weekend volunteer or a week volunteer opportunity in one of their ministries. When you fill out the paperwork, and that's the first formal step of entering, is you fill out the paperwork. You document when you received your sacraments, you document your educational background, and you fill in the paperwork and you hand it in, and the community accepts you.
Oh.
Then you become what some congregations call a candidate or a postulant.
So are you part of the congregation then, or the community?
You are living in with the community, and you are beginning the formation process.
Okay.
So it's an initial part of the community, not an official.
For your community, Sister Mary Kay, how long does the formation process take?
Total or just this part?
I guess, you know, if you can do the initial stage and then maybe the candidacy, and then we'll talk a little bit more about novitiate and we'll introduce some vocabulary.
So initial is 6 to 18 months and postulancy is 2 years.
Our thanks to Sister Lovina and Sister Mary Kay, and our thanks to our friends here at Relevant Radio 950 and 930 AM for letting us join you every Saturday morning. We thank you for listening. I'm Michael May for Catholic Chicago Week in Review. Have a great weekend.
Join us every Saturday morning for Catholic Chicago Week in Review.
You can stream our programs live or listen to past programs by visiting our website, archchicago.org, and clicking on Radio TV. And please connect with Catholic Chicago on social media.